Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Good day, this is Danny Parkinson. I am one of your hosts of Gay Mormon Stories, and today I have the privilege of interviewing John Gustav Rathall, which I manage to mess up every time. Most of you probably already know who he is. He's been very prominent in the Mormon blog community and in the Mormon intellectual community. He's done lots of presentations, or at least a few, at Sunstone over the years. He has participated with his own blog on the Bloggernacle. He has been a visible presence in the online forums, in both Mormon forums and in gay Mormon forums. He has recently come on board as one of the vice presidents in Affirmation, and he'll be starting his tenure there. I think he just started it. And he's got an amazing story that encompasses a lot of factors that we really want to highlight here on Gay Mormon Stories. And so I think you're going to really enjoy getting to know him by this interview. So let's get started. Do you want to introduce yourself, John, and correct what I just misspoke about your credentials?
I think you've pretty much got it right here. Sounds pretty good.
Well, is there something I left out? Or should we just fill that in as we proceed?
Yeah, maybe we can just fill that in as we go.
Okay, well, I'm going to follow the typical Mormon Stories format of starting at the beginning. And for most Mormons, the beginning is really your heritage and the precursors to your family's involvement in Mormonism. We don't have to get too much in that, but I think people are interested into what your Mormon heritage is and then your Mormon early life, okay?
Okay. Well, on my dad's side, I am a fifth-generation Mormon. And what that amounts to is at least one of my dad's ancestors was actually converted to the church in England in the 1830s and lived in Nauvoo for a time and sort of made that initial trek. I have other ancestors on my dad's side as well who converted later from Scandinavia and different parts of the British Isles mostly. And so I sort of have that whole Utah Mormon experience on his side, although Dad's parents basically moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania during the Great Depression. And my dad was actually born in Pittsburgh and grew up there. In fact, he was neighbors for a time with the family of Orrin Hatch, and my dad and Orrin were about the same age, roughly the same age, and were sort of playmates growing up. And eventually they moved to upstate New York, and after my dad finished his schooling at BYU, and then he did some graduate work at Yale, and eventually we ended up moving to Rochester, New York. And so I grew up in roughly the same part of the country that my dad was born in. And through him, I sort of have that Utah Mormon heritage that goes, you know, right back to the first generation of Mormons. My mom is a convert to the church, and she was born in eastern Finland. And she was actually baptized by my dad when he was serving his mission there. And I think just parenthetically, it's sort of interesting to mention that when my grandparents were living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, they came to know Henry Mattis. And my grandfather played a role in sort of converting him and bringing him into the church. And of course, he's the grandfather of Stuart Mattis. So Essentially my grandfather helped to convert Stuart's grandfather to the church. And Henry then went on to be the first mission president of Finland, which is the mission that my father served in and where he met my mother. So I've always thought those are just some interesting sort of gay Mormon connections.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's safe to say that you know, if it hadn't been for my grandfather converting Henry Mattis, maybe Stuart never would have been born. And if Henry...
Or maybe he'd still be alive.
Or maybe he'd still be alive. And if Henry hadn't become the first mission president of Finland, where my father served, you know, and where he met my mother, I might not have come into being. So, you know, definitely Mormonism has shaped my life in significant ways right from the very beginning. The family that I grew up in, both my mom and my dad, have always been very devout, active members of the church. I have four other siblings. I'm the oldest. And the kind of home that we grew up in, basically, I can count probably on one hand the number of Sundays that we missed going to church growing up. And we always kind of had, you know, we were raised with an assumption that you always say yes to every calling, you pay a full tithe, you live the word of wisdom, you basically just kind of do everything that is expected of you, and that's just part of how you live. We, growing up in a region of the United States where Mormons were a very small minority, also meant that I grew up with a very strong sort of missionary sense.
Yeah, you were... It was called the mission field in those days.
And it still is. It was the mission field. And, you know, growing up, I gave many books of Mormon as, you know, gifts to friends and teachers in school. And, in fact, one of my best friends, I had three very close friends in high school, and one of my best friends ultimately joined the church, and I helped the missionaries sort of do the discussions with him, and I actually baptized him before I went on my mission. So that's, you know, that gives some idea of the kind of home that I was raised in and just the kind of devotion that we had to the church.
And was your adolescence highly, you know, involved in the youth programs? And
oh, definitely.
Was your social world revolving around this in spite of your being at a school where you're a small minority?
Definitely. We pretty much, our social life, you know, pretty much totally centered around the church. And so we had, like, next-door neighbors that we grew up that we just literally didn't know.
Okay.
Because back in those days, it seemed like, you know, every other night there was some activity in the at the church, youth activities or, you know, various other, and we, of course, we had family home evening on Monday night, and we were very involved in church callings, and my dad served as a stake missionary and a ward missionary, and, you know, just my parents were so involved in various callings and activities that were really church-centered. You know, I had close friendships with non-Mormons in school, but I also had very close friendships with other youth that I was growing up with in my ward. And yeah, so I think our social life really kind of centered around the church, definitely.
Although you obviously had some non-Mormon friends if you managed to convert one
yes.
of them. And I'm just guessing that you were involved in the extracurricular activities at school, that the smart kids were doing, you know, the...
Some of that. There were some after-school clubs that I went to and things like that, and I played Dungeons & Dragons with my friends.
Uh-oh, and your parents let you?
They, you know, they didn't have the kinds of...
This is where they went wrong. It all goes back to Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, they, you know, they... It's funny because they didn't have any of the kinds of stereotypical concerns that a lot of parents at that time expressed about Dungeons and Dragons. My parents were more concerned about the fact that it was very time consuming.
Yeah.
Because I was usually the dungeon master for our group.
Okay.
So that's... I constantly had a little notebook with me. I was like drawing little maps and creating these adventures that we would be role playing with. And my dad would say, you know, boy, you sure spend a lot of time on Dungeons and Dragons. But I was a straight-A student, so ultimately they couldn't, you know, complain too much.
Well, we didn't have video games distracting us in those days either. There was just Pong and...
that's right.
It was pretty limited in the late 70s, right?
That's pretty much it, yeah.
Okay, well, so then you went on to college.
Yes, went to BYU. And, you know, it was pretty much assumed growing up that BYU is where I was going to go. And, in fact, when it came time to fill out college applications, all of my friends are selecting, you know, three or four or five or six of their sort of top pick universities, and I was filling out two applications. I filled out an application for BYU, and then my dad had me fill out an application for SUNY Buffalo just in case I didn't get into BYU. That turned out to not be a problem at all because the letter came back and I was informed that I was going to be a finalist for the Kimball Scholarship and actually became a Kimball Scholar.
And that wasn't easy then. It's even harder now, but it certainly a highly selective group to become a Kimball Scholar.
Right. But, you know, so needless to say, I didn't have any trouble getting into BYU, and it was assumed that that was where I was going. And I was excited about going to BYU. I wanted to be there. I thought it was really exciting to be in a church school. Of course, up until about the age of four, we lived in Utah because my dad was finishing his schooling at BYU. I was born in Provo, and so I was basically a BYU baby. But I remember the first time I went back to Utah, you know, since that time, to be interviewed for the Kimball Scholarship. And I remember just how exciting it was to me, you know, seeing the mountains as we were sort of coming in for a landing in Salt Lake and just kind of thinking to myself, you know, this is Zion. And I was really excited about being in a place and going to a church school and being in a place where there were lots of other Mormons who I assumed shared my values and I would sort of have that heritage in common.
So you hadn't even gone out to EFY or...
Not really.
So this was going to be your first experience really.
Yeah.
Absolutely where Mormons are now the majority.
Yep.
And you were excited about it.
I was excited at first.
Okay.
Well, it turned out to be a little bit different than I expected it to be. In fact, it was kind of disillusioning for me initially because, you know, I've had people call me on this, so I don't want this to come across as sounding too arrogant, but to me it felt like Mormons, that the Mormons that I knew and grew up with out East somehow seemed to, I don't know, take their faith a little bit more seriously than a lot of the people that I encountered in Utah. And I think it's, you know, now that I've had some time to sort of study sociology of religion and so on and, you know, understand the difference between that sort of church sect dynamic and, you know, in Utah, it's definitely a church. And in upstate New York, when I was growing up, it was definitely a sect. And so you definitely had that much more sort of, I don't know, your identity or your consciousness as a Mormon, if you're growing up in a Mormon minority area, I think by definition is going to be stronger in some ways than if you're growing up in a Mormon majority culture and place. But that was kind of disillusioning to me too. I think I had a very romanticized notion of what Zion was going to be, and it didn't live up to my imagination.
Yeah, it's interesting that BYU is shocking to just about everybody who goes there or not. I mean, for me, it was just, even though I came from Utah, it was also a different world. It seemed like everyone was from California, you know, and that's,
right.
That's even different. And I found I wasn't quite ready for the social, you know, I guess I found it to be more clicky than I thought it was going to be, and not this just open, loving place, but more of the sort of the same that we were extending from high school. So that was my freshman experience,
yeah.
Anyway. So I don't know if that was
similar. There probably was kind of some clickiness, and I kind of lucked out because, you know, being part of that Kimball Scholar crowd, there was a group of young men and young women that I had gotten to know well even before starting at BYU, and there were a few individuals in that group of incoming, or at least two of those individuals who were both from Brigham City, and they knew each other, and they had this like network of friends at BYU, and somehow I was sort of adopted into that little group of friends. So I actually had a pretty tight-knit group of people that I hung out with, and that we had lots of fun together. And so, you know, at least I definitely had that. I didn't feel like I was all alone in this, you know, big, huge, you know, 50,000 student, you know, college campus. So that was,
you know. And did you start on in the honors program, the honors colloquium courses?
Yes.
Which one did you take? Did you take Eugene England's course?
I did not. And I remember hearing everybody talk about Eugene England's course, and it just sounded like so, it was almost, I don't know, I want to say it was almost kind of cultish.
Yeah, well, I was a year ahead of you, and I was living on the honors floor. And, well, I wasn't on the honors floor, but they were in my ward. And so a lot of those guys were taking that course. And I was in a different honors colloquium, which I hated. I only took it one semester, but it was, so those guys were enjoying their experience, but I kind of hated mine. Which one did you take?
Let's see. It was some kind of Western culture thing. And we had a couple of professors from the German department who were part of that. And somebody from the physics department, and somebody from history and anthropology or something like that. And
But did you sort of get in, you know, into the honors scene? Or
Oh yeah,
it sounded like you were hanging out with the other Kimball scholars.
Oh yeah,
you were in the honors dorm, is that right?
Yep.
At Heritage Halls.
Yeah, I was living in the honors dorm. Right, there was like a floor that was sort of designated. And
okay, and you did 1 year there before your mission?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah. And so let's hear about that experience then.
Well, I basically, from the time I was about 16 years old, I had begun to do splits with the missionaries in the ward that I grew up in. And I was super excited about serving a mission. And I spent a lot of time talking to some of the older returned missionaries in my ward and having them tell me about their experience. And I remember there was this one brother who, I think he, as I recall, he was served as an advisor to the priest's quorum or something like that. And, and he was very sort of super excited about missionary work as well. And I remember having him come over to my house and sort of showing slides from his mission. And actually he had served in one of the French speaking missions. And I think it may even have been the Swiss Geneva mission. And so I was really super excited to hear from him, kind of telling about his missionary experiences. And so I was just really super charged about serving a mission. And I, you know, I put in my papers. When I got the papers back and learned where I was going to actually be serving, it was probably one of the most exciting days of my life.
Which was where?
The Swiss Geneva mission.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went to the MTC with great anticipation and great excitement. And I was determined to be the hardest working, best missionary that I possibly could be. And I was determined to go the extra mile. So if we were expected to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to do our scripture study and language study and so on, I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I was really good with languages. You know, I grew up in a bilingual home speaking
Finnish.
So you
started, but you didn't know French already. You learned it in the MTC.
No, I learned it in the MTC. I had not studied French at all. In fact, I had secretly hoped that I would get sent to either Finland or Germany because, like I said, I was bilingual Finnish and English growing up. And then I studied German all through high school. And I thought it would be really cool to go to some Nordic place. And I ended up going to France, which was totally fine. I really didn't care where I went. So I had to learn a new language. But I was really good with the languages, picked up the French really quick. In fact, I sort of got a nickname at the MTC. They called me le dictionnaire ambulant, the walking dictionary, because I could read over a vocabulary list once or twice and pretty much memorize it. So I arrived in France. My first assignment was in Toulon, France, which is right on the sort of western edge of the Côte d'Azur, the Azure coast. And I just couldn't get to work fast enough. You know, I wanted to just get out right away and start talking to people and meeting people. And I was so anxious to, you know, share the message of the gospel. And so I was a really, really super eager missionary. And I think my senior companions had a really hard time with me because they were not, you know, they were a little bit more seasoned.
Probably jaded, because if in those missions, I know that baptisms were, even teaching was not a regular event.
That's correct.
I went to a French-speaking mission around that time.
And that's correct. And the mission average was one baptism per missionary per mission.
Yeah.
And I ended up baptizing five people. And I was very, very frustrated with my senior companions because in my mind, they didn't work hard enough. They didn't do enough. And, you know, the first missionary companion that I had seemed to want to spend a lot of time hanging out over at the sister missionary's apartment, sort of just talking and visiting. And I arrived in the mission field sort of in the midst of the Christmas season.
Okay.
And so all the missionaries were like, oh, we can't do any missionary work right now. Everybody's with their families. They're all doing, you know, nobody's going to want to talk to us right now. And I was like, no. I want to go out and knock on doors. That's why I'm here. So that it was really tough for me. And I mean, looking back now, I feel like it was probably one of the most important lessons that I learned was about being compassionate and letting go of some of those kinds of expectations and just letting people be and letting people do what they need to do and kind of learning from that and learning from them. I there was probably a lot more that I could have learned from some of those senior companions that I didn't, because I at some point decided that they weren't faithful enough or whatever. But I was really happy when I finally became a senior companion myself.
Okay.
And I could call the shots.
And you could.
And then I had junior companions who were kind of complaining about the frenetic pace that I wanted to set.
The
intensity. I always wanted to be out working an hour later. That was kind of the pace that I carried throughout the mission. And my final calling in the mission was as the branch president of a very small branch in southeastern France, down by the Spanish border in Béziers, France. And that was a really kind of an eye-opening experience for me, too, to be in that kind of leadership position and sort of have to deal with all of the problems and challenges of a small branch and kind of deal with the personalities and the conflicts. And that was, you know, that was a really, really interesting experience.
And this was the days of 18-month missions, those,
yes,
that short window of history when they were only 18 months.
Yes. And, you know, that probably exacerbated my impatience because I remember feeling like, you know, I've had 6 months taken away from me.
Okay.
And so I have to make it count even that much more.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So you finished up your mission and you came home after 18 months. So if you were starting, this must have got you home towards the beginning of summer or late spring.
Yeah. That sounds about right, because I remember one of the first things that I did after I got back from my mission is my parents had, unbeknownst to me, signed me up for the Hilcomora pageant to be a cast member of the pageant. And I got involved in that almost immediately after getting back from my mission, and that the pageant is usually in the summer, so I'm guessing that that it was probably late spring, early summer is probably about when I got back.
Okay, so that was smart on your mother's part, I suppose, to let you transition in that way back to the real world.
Right.
Because I suppose they participating in Hilcomore isn't exactly the real world either.
No, it wasn't. But it was really interesting. You know, had some great friendships there, but I had, I was there, we had just sat in on one of the devotionals, and I heard this woman sobbing and sort of talking in very anxious tones in French. And I, was sort of intrigued, and I went over and I introduced myself, and I said, I spoke in French, and I said, I apologize. I don't mean to be eavesdropping, but it seems that you're pretty upset, and I wonder if there's anything I can do to help. And this woman explained that she and her family had come down from Quebec to participate in the Hilcomore pageant, and her husband and kids spoke fairly passable English, but she didn't understand any English at all, and she was sobbing because she couldn't understand the devotionals, and she felt really terrible that she couldn't participate in this spiritual aspect of the pageant. And
she was a member of the church.
She's a member of the church. And so and she's part of the cast with her family. And so I basically volunteered to sort of be her personal interpreter.
Okay.
And so I followed the family around and basically...
You had to learn Québécois then.
I had to learn Québécois.
French. That's what I spoke.
Right.
It ain't the same.
So it felt kind of like a missionary experience. It felt very related to my mission, which was kind of cool.
Okay, and then back to BYU.
Back to BYU. So that's when things, started to get complicated in terms of dealing with the sexuality, and I don't know if that's something you wanted to segue to at this point. Or...
Well, if we're going to start talking about that and in this context, let's go back a little bit, and why don't you just tell me if there was any inklings during your youth or childhood or even your earlier on your mission, etc., about your orientation, and if that had arisen in your mind as a conflict.
Yes.
When did you very first come
My very first, I remember that I was about 10 or 11 years old when I first became aware of sexual fantasies that I would have about other guys my own age. And I say I remember 10 or 11 years old because I remember when I was becoming aware of these feelings or fantasies or whatever, I was definitely aware of, preparing to be a deacon and feeling like these fantasies were, these thoughts were out of line and inappropriate for what I was trying to be. And so I do remember feeling guilty about that. And, I remember wishing that I could have better control over my thoughts and fantasies. And I remember that's why that talk by Boyd K. Packer about, the channels, he talks about, when you have water and you're trying to get water to flow a certain way, that the best way to get it to go where you want it to go is to, dig a channel for it. And, he encouraged people to memorize hymns and to think of uplifting things, scriptures, that could help you to send your thoughts in a more uplifting channel. And I remember being really motivated by that talk by Boyd K. Packer. I remember my grandmother used to visit us once a year, and Grandma would go on these brisk walks early in the morning, and she memorized hymns, and she would hum or sing these hymns to herself as she went on these walks. And I would go on these early morning walks, and I remember thinking, this is a wonderful thing, that I wanted to do that same thing as my grandmother had done as a way to sort of help channel my thoughts. So I remember being concerned about that at that age, at 10 or 11. And it wasn't until I was about 14 years old that I actually applied the label homosexual to myself.
Okay, so you figured it out somehow.
Yeah. Basically,
because I had those thoughts too, but it, I didn't make any connection or give them any importance.
Well, I was very aware that I was extremely attracted to other guys in my deacons and teachers and priest quorums, and I had one particularly close friend, and there were, you know, we would, like, I'd visit a friend's house and we'd do these overnights. And I remember there was this one guy in my, at that time it was my teacher's quorum, that I was particularly attracted to, a very strong attraction to this guy. And I was on an overnight at his place, and I remember we kind of slept on this sofa bed, and he basically kind of stripped down to his, like, underwear, these sort of tight colored briefs, and so I stripped down to my underwear as well, and so we were lying there in bed, you know, virtually naked. Absolutely nothing happened. I mean, we were completely chaste, and he, like, went off to sleep, and I was awake literally the entire night.
Okay.
And I was very aware of this strong desire to, like, hold him, to hug him, to, you know, be physically close to him, to touch him. And all night I'm ruminating on these feelings that I have. And then the next morning after we got up and sort of went about our activities, I was still thinking about this, and it really upset me. And at that point, you know, I was aware of the word homosexual, and I looked it up in a dictionary the next morning after that sleepover. And I read the definition, and I was like, yep, that's what I am. Okay. So I pretty much knew it at age 14.
Yeah, that was better than I did. I had zero insight into what all this meant. But was it... did it strike you as a terrible thing?
Yes. Yeah, okay. It did. And so then I started to, and at this point I confided this in no one. I guess I imagined terrible consequences coming from revealing this to anybody. I thought that I would be viewed as mentally ill. I would probably need to, you know, I would probably be referred to a therapist. I didn't know if my bishop would consider me unworthy. And so in my mind, it was better to really just kind of figure this out and fix it on my own.
Yeah.
And so I started to try to read stuff about it. And my main source for how to deal with this were books like The Miracle of Forgiveness.
Okay.
Stephen R. Covey's Spiritual Roots of Human Relations.
So shame and guilt based.
Pretty much. I mean, President Kimball didn't have things to say about this that were that I would describe as particularly helpful to me. But I guess it seemed helpful at the time. I mean, I thought, because basically I got that message that you might have this affliction, but if you are faithful, you know, if you pray, if you study the scriptures, if you fulfill your callings faithfully, if you do everything that is asked of you, if you live close to the Spirit, that you will overcome this, you'll be able to marry, you'll be able to live a normal, happy life, and everything will work out and be hunky-dory. And so I put my faith in that.
So you bought into that and assumed that this would
I bought into it. And that is why from the age of 14 on, I became a super Mormon.
So that was part of your motivation then for
yes.
becoming intensely devout.
It was an explicit motivation. And like I mentioned that from the age of 16 on, I was going on weekly splits with the missionaries in my ward. I was seeking out those kinds of things because I thought if I do this, if I am as faithful as I possibly can be, the Lord will take this away from me.
And were you having sort of the quintessential Mormon experience of having super shame about masturbation, or was it something that you somehow miraculously could not do?
No, that was another area. And, you know, I had sort of been put on notice about that by my dad before my first interview to become a deacon. And he had kind of explained the whole concept of masturbation to me and explained to me that he hoped that, you know, Dad put it in a very gentle way. He just said, if these questions come up in your worthiness interviews, I hope that you'll be able to answer those questions in a way that, you know, is worthy.
Okay.
And so I knew that I wasn't supposed to be masturbating.
I mean, I remember when I was this age, I heard a talk in the priesthood session where, and I think it was President Kimball said, you know, if there is a boy who hasn't masturbated and hasn't engaged in homosexuality and hasn't fornicated, that is a very, you know, strong, valiant warrior. And so he sort of put all three of those in the same category, right?
Right.
I mean, unfortunately, the church doesn't view all three of those in the same category.
Right.
But in that little moment, masturbation was right there with homosexual and fornication, at least in the perspective.
In my mind, because I think in the Miracle of Forgiveness, Spencer W. Kimball lists masturbation as something that can lead to homosexuality. I sort of mentally latched onto that, and so I felt incredibly guilty about my masturbation because I basically thought, this is why I'm in this predicament now.
Okay.
Of having these feelings toward other guys is because I masturbated. So I really harbored some terrible guilt about that. And I made very valiant efforts to avoid masturbating as a youth.
Did you try all the tricks Mark Peterson suggested?
Well,
tie your hand to the bed.
I can tell you, you know, the tricks
sleep
that
with the Book of Mormon.
I tried, you know, I think I managed to avoid, you know, frequent masturbation. You know, I want to say maybe prior to my mission, I would succumb to the temptation maybe once every month or every other month. One of the tricks that I resorted to is I actually started going to bed fully clothed.
Oh, that's in Mark Peterson's pamphlet. That's one of his ideas.
And I would go to bed with the lights on so that if I would sort of wake up in the middle of the night, the light would help me sort of come to a sort of full level of mental alertness so that I could have more control over, you know, and wearing, you know, going to bed fully clothed made it harder for the hands to just easily wander while I was half asleep. So, yeah, I mean, there were definitely some things that I did, and I masturbated very infrequently, but I had very frequent wet dreams.
Well, that's pretty heroic if you're able to go a month at a time, in my opinion.
Well, I couldn't win because then I would feel guilty about the wet dreams.
Oh, so you didn't even see wet dreams as being an okay...
Well, I had heard, you know, and I remember, I think it was Boyd K. Packer who had more or less said, you know, that's not something you need to be worried about. But I remember feeling guilty about them, because they were so frequent. Because I had them, like, growing up, I had them, like, every other night. I would have a wet dream.
And presumably you'd have erotic dreams associated with that.
Yes, and so... So in my mind, the frequency of them and the fact that I was having these erotic dreams that accompanied them, in my mind, it sort of made me think, is this because I don't have sufficient control over my thoughts? You know, are my thoughts going into these unholy channels? And is that why I'm having these frequent wet dreams? So there was this kind of, you know, low-level tension and anxiety throughout, you know, from that time on, really. The first time I masturbated was, I was 14 years old. And really from that time on, I managed to control myself, you know, throughout my entire mission, except for two instances.
Which is also heroic.
In that 18-month period. And I wrote a letter to my mission president confessing this sin or this failing, and my mission president, I remember he went on a tour, and this was when I was branch president in Béziers. He arrived in Béziers. He arrived at the missionary apartment. He did sort of one-on-one worthiness interviews with me and my companion. And I remember him sort of pulling the letter, the confession letter that I'd written him, you know, sort of out of his file. And he just said to me, "I got your letter." He said, "Have you had any issues since you've sent me this letter?" And I said, "No." And he then, in front of me, he ripped the letter up and, you know, threw it into a waste paper bin. And that was his way of dealing with
it. Well, that seems like a good
one. Yeah.
Or better than some of the...
But
going back to your teen years then, did this kind of really lead to other problems for you, like depression or just this? Because you had this gnawing. I mean, the masturbation thing, that's universal. It's not just gays who are... Every Mormon young person has this as part of their formation, which is to go through this guilt, feeling like they're a horrible sinner, because we all kind of believe that and no one's exempt, right?
Right.
But as a gay person, you put it all right there as to this is just all the more reason why as a gay person you're a terrible person. So I just wondered if how much were you really internalizing that?
I don't think I was depressed as a youth. I think that I did it fairly well, and the way I dealt with it was I saw this as kind of a deferred thing, right? I mean, I certainly wasn't acting out homosexually.
Right.
Right. I mean, I'll just put this out on the table now. I was a virgin until I was 24 years old. So being celibate was not a problem, and I certainly struggled with the masturbation, but you know, probably the major manifestation for me was that when I reached that magical age of 16, when we're supposed to finally be allowed to date as Mormon kids growing up, I had no interest in dating at all. And I remember, you know, my younger brother was like, "Oh, you get to date. Oh, you're so lucky." You know, I don't think I went on a date until I was like halfway through my 18th year.
Okay.
And there was this young woman in the ward who was really interested in me, and she asked me on a date. And in fact, we went on a number of dates, and she was always the initiator and the instigator, and I was never really interested in that at all. But
not even for the social benefit of going with your friends and you all take the girls and then you drop off the girls when you're done. And
I didn't really do that until I was at BYU and hanging out with my Brigham City gang.
Okay.
And because they were all into that, you know, they were all into these big group date things. And then, you know, so then I would ask a young woman to go on a date with me so that I could be, you know, part of the group. But that was, you know, not really much of a dynamic. Although, you know, I went on a number of double dates in high school. But it didn't interest me. And at that point in my life, I could actually feel kind of righteous about that. Because, you know, I wasn't supposed to be seriously dating at that point in my life. And so I was able to kind of put all that stuff on hold until after my mission. And that's why the depression, the anxiety, the crisis really didn't hit until after I came back from my mission.
But what about some of the other dynamics of, for example, being a missionary, being with your companion? I mean, for me, Mormonism, we grew up playing sports together. We took showers together.
Right.
We went skinny dipping in the pond in the woods together. And the missionary experience was, for me, where I really started getting these intense feelings, and I didn't even know what they were, but I just really liked these bonding experiences with the other missionaries. And it didn't lead to anything too terribly outside of the White Handbook, but we were affectionate. We gave massages to each other. We were sleeping in the same bed, not with our companions. So if we were on a split, we would make sure we weren't sleeping with our companion. But we were doing all these things that, for me, it was... I really liked this because it was this male bonding, this intense male bonding, and I didn't I was kind of getting the idea that it was probably homosexuality that was making it appeal to me, but well, it was an intense time.
You know, I can tell you one funny story. On one of those many splits, missionary splits that I went on as a youth before I went on my mission, I remember arriving at the missionary apartment one evening for a split, and I had arrived a little bit early and, you know, knocked on the door, and one of the missionaries brought me up to the apartment, and the companions that I was going to be going on the split with were, like, in bed, in their garments, like, having a wrestling match.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We did that.
And I remember being really turned on by this.
That must have been part of your motivation for all these splits with older missionaries. Well, you were in high school. I could have been.
I mean, you know, I wrote my book about the Young Men's Christian Association and about intense friendship. And certainly, I intensely admired the missionaries, yeah. And I think that, you know, the fact that they were very attractive young men was definitely, you know, may have been sort of an unconscious motivator for me. But
I mean, a unique thing about being gay is that you have an eroticism towards people, but they are also role models. So right. It's sometimes one, it's sometimes the other, it's sometimes both. And you see, you know, I remember in high school these different leaders we had who were kind of young adults, but who were assigned to us, and just being so intrigued by them, and everyone thought they were great.
Yeah.
And but it was partly role model, but it was partly an infatuation. And,
right.
And so I can sort of see it being sort of innocent and not necessarily sublimation of all your homosexual feelings, right? Because the role model thing is big, and even heterosexual kids, they really admire the group just older than them. And,
right. Well, you know, when I was on my mission, it was a challenge because I did remember, or, you know, I did have this feeling of this could be really challenging for me to sort of deal with these feelings and these urges. And, like, I remember at the MTC, you know, they had these big group showers.
Yeah.
And
back in those days, they had mesh garments, which were about as revealing as you could get.
Right, and on more than one occasion, you know, I would get aroused in the showers. In fact, there was this one very humiliating occasion when I, you know, basically sort of had a full erection, and I went to, like, go grab my towel, and my roommates thought it was really hilarious to, like, steal my clothes and my towel and, you know, take it back to the locker room and lock me out of my... And I was humiliated. I mean, I was really upset. And so there were some of those kinds of situations. And that was also, you know, I said I would get up an hour earlier than everybody else to be that much harder working. Well, that was part of the motivation as well, because if I got up an hour earlier, I could have the showers all to myself.
Okay.
And I could avoid some of those really potentially humiliating and what to me just felt like dangerous situations. So there was some kind of... It was challenging, and I was physically attracted to every companion that I had.
Okay.
From the MTC on throughout my entire mission.
Were there certain friends, sometimes maybe it wasn't even a companion, but a district member or someone who where you really had a tight bond, or you really sublimated some of the...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I you know, I had these very intense feelings for everybody that I interacted with in my mission, but I remember... There was this kind of moment for me when I had first arrived. It was my first night in the mission field in Toulon, France. And I had been met by my companion at the train station, and we bought some food on the way home to the apartment. We arrived, and we did a sort of an evening prayer and scripture study together. And before the scripture study began, my companion got undressed. He just sort of stripped down to his garments, and I did too. And we sort of sat down at the table, and we had our scriptures, and he was sort of reading, and we were kind of discussing and doing the scripture study together. And I was getting aroused. Like, it was concealed by the table.
Okay.
But I remember feeling this was extremely awkward, and how do I get out of this without him seeing that
that I'm feeling aroused right now with him. And of course, eventually it went away and I was fine. But I remember just after he went to bed and the lights were out, and I remember just weeping in my cot. We literally had like cots in this very small apartment. And I remember just weeping and praying to the Lord and saying, how can I serve you if I have these kinds of feelings? Because I just, at that point, I was feeling so unworthy about the feelings that I, whatever it was that I had experienced. And I remember the Spirit comforting me. And I remember sort of having this feeling of, the Lord accepts your offering. Don't worry about it. You're going to be able to handle it, and you're going to do just fine. And the Lord is proud of you and is proud of the service that you're offering. And so that sort of spiritual experience kind of helped me at least get past that point of feeling like I'm so unworthy. I can't even do this. Because literally I had been, you know, there were all these scenarios like I should call the mission president tomorrow and just tell him I need to go home or whatever. And that spiritual experience that I had sort of kept me engaged and sort of gave me the confidence. And ultimately I was able to manage that just fine. And, you know, so missionary service ended up being just fine. And I bonded with a number of my companions, especially later on in the mission when I was gradually becoming less impatient and becoming more sort of patient and loving,
right,
and considerate of my companions.
More flexible.
Less
rigid.
Less rigid, exactly.
Part of growing up.
It is part of growing up, and that was a major spiritual, my mission was a major spiritual turning point for me, I think, and it taught me a lot about the importance of compassion. Both compassion toward myself and compassion toward others. But I also do kind of remember feeling like when I came home from my mission, you know, like I remember looking at the letter, the release letter, where and it said, you know, has honorably served. And I remember looking at that word honorably and thinking, if they really knew, would they feel the same way about me? So that was really a trial. And yeah. Then, you know, that was when the pain really began, because literally, you know, so I go to the Hill Cumorah pageant that summer and I'm kind of hanging out at home. And then I go to BYU the next fall. I arrive in my BYU ward and literally the first thing that my bishop says to me, my new bishop, his first words to me are, well, you've faithfully served your mission. Now, your number one task is to find a wife.
And that has been, unfortunately, off your radar for your whole mission.
All right.
And now reality is going to set in here.
That was when reality started to set in. Yeah, so basically, I had that at the back of my head. I was dating. I dated a number of young women at BYU. Never really graduated to anything really serious. Like I said, most of the dates that I went on were basically like group dates. Mm-hmm. It was more of a kind of social thing. Often it was other of my friends who would sort of initiate it and, you know, get me to come along and bring along a date. And there were a number of young women that I regarded, you know, basically as kind of friends, and that I felt comfortable sort of turning to and saying, hey, you want to go on a date? But for me, there was absolutely nothing like romantic in it. Or
were the other guys all raving about the joys of kissing and how much they just love to kiss?
Well, you know, okay. I think I may have mentioned to you that my three closest friends at BYU all turned out to be gay.
Oh, okay. So maybe they weren't raving about kissing.
So, yeah. So that wasn't so much for me. But, you know, I knew guys in my student ward who were, you know, clearly like girl crazy in a way that I simply couldn't comprehend. And there was this whole sort of, you know, marriage scene at BYU, you know, where people would date for relatively short periods of time and then, you know, proposals would start flying. And I just literally couldn't conceive of it. And as I said, my three closest friends ended up being gay, although none of us were out to each other at BYU. This was something I didn't discover about them until long after I had left BYU, but there were guys that I definitely had a crush on.
Uh-huh.
And so there would be situations, for example, where friends of mine would go out on a date and I would be like, I really want to be with so-and-so, with this guy. And, you know, I would call my guy friends and we would do things together. And I really, really, like, that was like the high point for me, for my social life, was to be able to just spend one-on-one time with these guys. And
were you talking about the gay friends or are you talking about any friend?
Well, one of them was gay, and he and I would go for these very long walks together. We'd have these very deep sort of heart-to-heart talks. I was really excited to be with him. I really enjoyed being with him. We would read poetry together. We'd write poetry together. It was so gay. It was so gay. You can't believe it.
Yeah.
And
very Victorian.
Very Victorian. Very Victorian. So, like, when I, in my book, you know, when I write about these intense male friendships in the 19th century, I kind of feel like I had experienced that. I remember there was this one point on one of these long walks where this friend of mine just stopped and embraced me, like gave me this sort of full body hug and held me. And, you know, I don't think I was ever happier than I was in that particular moment. So I was definitely aware of these feelings, and there were sort of indirect, like I remember confiding in one of the other gay friends and sort of talking to him about how I really just had no interest in women. And he said, well, are you interested in men? And I wasn't able to really own up to that out loud yet at that point.
But that a question occurred to him.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was also in that.
Oh, yeah. But so the fact that he asked me that question and the fact that I knew that the answer to that question was, yes, this is how I feel about guys.
Yeah.
But that I couldn't admit it to him.
Right.
That really bothered me. And
it bothered you they couldn't admit it, or it bothered you that the answer was yes, or both?
Both. And so what I realized is that there was this whole dynamic inside of me that I just had no control over. And I was starting to get severely depressed.
So you'd been back a year already around this time, or?
Yeah, right. So the depression got worst in my junior year at BYU.
Uh-huh. But you were able to maintain your grades. You were.
I was a straight A student. In fact, school was basically sort of the one outlet that I had, you know, where I could just kind of get my mind off of all of these problems and just focus on doing well academically. And I excelled academically. I think I had like a 3.96 grade point average at BYU. And
were you majoring in?
History.
Okay.
And
that was in the days when Michael Quinn was there.
Yes. I had Michael Quinn for a couple of classes. I had Bill Bradshaw taught a couple of honors religion classes that I took from him. I took an honors biology class from him. I remember Bill Bradshaw really kind of helped me to understand the whole concept of evolution and how that can work theologically within an LDS framework. And, you know, so I had wonderful, wonderful professors. And Mike Quinn and Bill Bradshaw were probably the two BYU professors that I had that whom I most admired and whom I really saw as role models.
Yeah.
Mike Quinn, I remember when I had first started to become aware of some of the faith-related challenges around church history. And I remember going to Mike Quinn's office, and I just felt like I needed to talk to him about some of these issues. And I've talked to him since, and he said, you know, he remembered me just coming to him literally in tears, like tears just running down my face because I didn't know how to resolve this. And I remember him just reassuring me and saying to me, John, church history is not a minefield. He said, there is nothing that you will learn in church history that in itself can destroy your testimony. And then he shared with me his, you know, sort of his sense of things and how it worked. And Mike Quinn shared with me his testimony. And from that moment, you know, he was a hero to me.
Yeah.
Because I thought, here is somebody who is making it work. He's a skilled, trained historian. He understands the historical issues. He has the faith. He has the testimony. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to have that kind of intellect and also that kind of testimony of the gospel.
And it's ironic that he really was trying to present an approach of accepting the history but staying in the church and staying a believer. And it's sort of ironic that the path that his life took in his relationship with the church, but that he still seems to hold to that. And it's kind of amazing how the church might have shot itself in the foot, because there's a lot of people who maybe would have stayed if they'd listened to people like him who actually left because of historical reasons. And now that they are more interested in maybe opening up to the...
Right.
Accepting this historical stuff, you know, all this time lost that...
Well,
Michael Quinn could have been an ally, but anyway.
That's, well, not only that, not only that, but I credit Michael Quinn with my return to the church, because again, he provided that kind of model. And even after he had been excommunicated, and I had, you know, I spoke with him. He was one of the few Mormons that I had contact with outside of my family after I was excommunicated from the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to Mike Quinn on the phone and, you know, him sort of talking to me about his faith. And I remember being just so deeply impressed, first of all, that, and this was after he had been excommunicated.
Okay.
And I remember that I was amazed, like, how calm he was about it and how I sensed no bitterness or anger or hatred toward the church in the conversations that I had with him.
Well, good for him.
And I remember kind of being awestruck by that. And then, you know, we'll talk later about the spiritual experiences that I had that brought me back to the church. But when I came to that point where I was starting to come back to the church, I remember thinking, he's my role model.
Yeah.
He's the person who... You know, he showed me some ways to be faithful and sort of hold on to your testimony. And it, in spite of having been treated a certain way, or, you know, in spite of having been excluded from the church or excommunicated from the church. So that, in many ways, I think I've kind of modeled my path after that, or at least, you know, after my perception of how he went about this. So I feel like I owe a lot personally to Michael Quinn. Bill Bradshaw was a similar kind of figure in my mind. You know, again, somebody who had an intellect that I really admired, a very intelligent, very educated, a very articulate man who also had, you know, a very strong testimony of the gospel. And those were the people that I really wanted to be like.
Okay. But meanwhile, you were having a lot of negative experiences to go with these few positive ones.
Right. So basically, in my junior year, I'm kind of hanging on by a thread. And toward the end of the junior year is when I started to wish to die. And then I started to sort of think of these like suicide scenarios.
Not just the sex. So You were wishing to die? Why? You did at this point, the outlook just looks so bleak. When did it occur to you that marriage and a heterosexual marriage was impossible? Or, I mean, why did things suddenly, suddenly, but why did things develop into such a bleak direction that you actually wanted
to die? Well, basically what happened is I moved into a new apartment, and so I was basically moved into a new BYU ward. And shortly after I'd moved into that ward, my bishop, I got a call from a counselor in the bishopric, and I was told that they wanted to interview me for a calling, and I think it was like a ward clerk calling. And so they took me in, and it was almost kind of an assembly line, you know, and they had like one of the counselors in the bishopric was sort of sitting in the office, and there was like a row of us sitting outside the office and going in one after another. And basically it was like a 30-second interview where he'd basically just say, do you feel that you have any worthiness issues that you need to discuss with the bishop? And if you said no, then, you know, he'd hand you your calling and, you know, send you on your way. And when he asked me that question, I said, I think I do have some worthiness issues I need to discuss with my bishop. So he set that appointment up. So I go in to see my bishop. And at this point, I am feeling guilty about the same-sex attraction thing, but it's impossible for me to talk about. And so the one thing that I can talk about is the masturbation.
So you had still never mentioned to another human being that this was an issue
no,
in your life?
No, but I'm definitely aware of it at this point. I'm definitely struggling with it, and I'm feeling guilty about it, and that's probably why I had asked for the interview.
And just a question about your awareness of homosexuality. Did you have any information whatsoever? Did you kind of know, well, there's these gays in San Francisco, or there's this AIDS thing, or, I mean, were you connecting to anything going around you in the world that had to do with homosexuality? Were you informed, or were these news stories jumping at you when they would come to the
forefront? Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, this was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, right? This is the early 80s now that I'm there, and we're starting to hear the first reports about AIDS, and we're starting to see that AIDS is being connected to homosexuality. And so, and I think I may have even said something really snide and horrible to one of my roommates at BYU about how, like, well, if you were going to choose to be gay, you know, this is the worst possible time to do it, you know, because of this disease. And in one of the social history classes that I had taken from Mike Quinn, we actually did some readings on the Kinsey report, and he actually had a couple of articles on history of sexuality. And so I was becoming aware of issues academically too.
Okay.
But
did you actually know a gay person who called himself gay?
No.
So you had never met breathing person who?
No, absolutely not. So it was traumatic for me, and I was, you know, dealing with all these feelings of something must be wrong with me, I must be unworthy for me to even have these thoughts, these feelings, these emotions.
But and what you confessed to your bishop was really
I confessed masturbation to my bishop, and my bishop did something that sort of stunned me. He took away my temple recommend. He said, you're not going to receive a calling. And he said, I would like you to refrain from taking the sacrament until you have been masturbation free for at least 3 months.
Wow.
And I was kind of stunned because I'd had another BYU bishop that I'd confessed the whole masturbation thing. And he had even kind of joked with me about, you know, oh, well, you could wear boxing gloves to bed or, you know, something like that. Unfortunately, he didn't really reassure me that this wasn't something I needed to be worried about. He was sort of content to just let me struggle with it, but he didn't he didn't tell me I couldn't take the sacrament or anything like that. But this bishop's, you know, took away my temple recommend, which was devastating to me because at that point, you know, like the temple was one of these places that I could go where I could feel the spirit and feel holy and feel sort of embraced by the love of God. And I loved going into the celestial room and just kind of sitting in there and meditating. And, And when he took away that temple recommend, it was devastating to me. And so I'm sitting there kind of stunned. And I said to him, you know, I've been struggling with this my whole life. And I said, I don't know how to do what you're asking of me. And I said, I don't think I can do this for 3 months. And I said, do you have any recommendations for me? Like, do you have any suggestions? What can I do? And he said to me, get married as soon as you possibly can.
Yep. And that's why they get married after 3 months of engagement, right?
And I literally got up, I walked out of that office, and I thought, I'm never going to be worthy again in my life. That was the moment. From that time on was when I started to think, how can I end my life?
I mean, let's just talk about what's going on with the other students. The other students are either not confessing and just
right.
ignoring it and just, you know, but they're still in the back of their mind. They're not living the gospel and they're just in denial, or else they are. And then they're desperate to get married so they can be righteous again. But you don't have this, you don't even have the hope of this salvation, which is to,
right.
which is the only possible escape that he could come up with. Wasn't an escape available to you. Yeah. So
that was it.
It was a bleak outlook.
Yeah, because I thought I was just like, marriage is, at that point it was clear to me that marriage was more and more just literally impossible. And, you know, I would even just, I mean, I would try to do like these thought experiments or these like visioning, like I would imagine one of the women that I was dating. And I would try to imagine myself living in a house with her, sleeping in the same bed with her, having sex with her. I mean, literally, I was trying to, like, picture this. And, like, I had this very awkward sort of mental image, like, when I try to imagine myself having sex with this woman that I... If there was anybody I could have asked to marry me, it would have been her. And I would try to imagine myself in this scenario, and all I could imagine was us sort of circling around the bed like two wrestlers in a wrestling ring, but never actually making physical contact. Like, in my head, it was just literally impossible. And the thought of marriage just seemed like fiction to me. Like a fantasy story that you'd make up. It was not something that I could envision as something that I could actually do.
Right.
And, I mean, the big breakthrough for me in terms of, you know, sort of understanding what my sexual orientation meant was that when I performed the opposite thought experiment of, like, okay, now imagine you doing this with a man. It all fell together. It was like, I can see this happening. I understand exactly how this works. I understand exactly how I relate to him physically as a life partner in every way. For me, that visioning experiment took me literally to where I am now. You know,
and having, you were going down this thought path in those days?
I was starting to go down that thought path. Mm. And it began as we could just live together as friends. Or another thought experiment that I had was, what if he married and I married, but we moved into houses and lived right next door to each other, and every day I would come home from work and we'd eat dinner together.
I had that same fantasy.
Isn't that funny?
I would like to marry my friend's sister.
Yeah, so I was starting to have some of those kinds of thoughts, but of course for me at that point that was beyond the pale. And so just literally, I thought, so my faith at that point starts to fall apart. I'm like not even sure, because then there's this kind of anger reaction too, because to me it was so clear that this was not anything that I had chosen. By that point, it was clear to me that this was just, and I was, you know, I was beginning to be aware of some of the data, you know, the Kinsey data and the, as I said, I learned about that in college. And so I started to have some facts that were helping me to contextualize this.
But you never went the line of therapy. It never occurred to you to go say, I can get cured of this somehow.
No,
you
not
somehow
really.
Know that that was realistic, even though back then they kind of...
There was part of me that wondered if I shouldn't have given that kind of therapy a chance. Although I think I sincerely did doubt that it could possibly work, just because I had no concept of how would that work.
Because Evergreen was thriving in those days. That was their...
That could well be, but I think it was also just hard for me because the thought of going that route seemed so humiliating to me.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, how do I do that without my parents finding out, without my bishop finding out, without all these people finding out? And I really just kind of wanted it to go away. And, I mean, based on what I had read by church leaders, I didn't understand why it couldn't just go away through faithfulness and prayer and obedience. And so, I don't know, therapy just kind of didn't... It didn't seem like a route that could work for me in any way. So by that point, and now this is really funny because, you know, I was telling you how my three closest friends were all gay. Well, they were all sort of going through similar crises right about the same time. And I remember hearing, you know, one of these friends of mine who happened to be my roommate at the time was starting to talk about suicide. And I remember being alarmed by what he was saying. And I remember calling the BYU counseling office and saying, what should I do if I have a friend who's talking about suicide? And, you know, I remember them saying, well, see if you can encourage him to come in and talk to somebody here. And so I was trying to take care of my friend, even as I myself was starting to think, okay, when I go home this summer, we have two family cars. I'm going to wait until my parents take one and leave me at home alone with the other. And then I'm going to close the garage doors and I'm going to just turn on the car and like go to sleep in the garage. And somehow for me, there was no disconnect between wanting to save the life of one of my best friends and thinking I can't go on any longer.
You were making a plan.
I had a plan, and you know, literally.
But your friend still couldn't connect you with you as to why you were feeling suicidal, why he was feeling suicidal, even though you now know it was the same.
We weren't talking about it really at all. I mean, and he was doing the same thing I was doing. I mean, he was, you know, he was basically sort of using his academics as his outlet. We were both Kimball scholars. We were both, you know, straight-A students. We would take these crazy schedules. In fact, it was almost like we had a competition with each other to see who could take more credits and still get, you know, straight A's.
Yeah.
So it was kind of getting out of control and couldn't last. I mean, that summer, basically, I would have committed suicide, I think, if it hadn't been for, you know, a providential encounter.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com. That
Why should this anxious load press down your weary mind? Haste to your heavenly Father's throne and sweet refreshment find. His goodness stands approved, unchanged from day to day. I'll drop my breath.